This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'll try to actually get to the point, even though it's the most difficult thing for me. But I actually took seriously this question, and I decided to select, of course, a few images to contextualize the issues in this case, and of course, having to do with the investigation, with the research that has inspired my work at this very contested border where I live, San Diego, Tijuana. And of course, I wish that I could have taken the time to really explain a bit the meaning or the inspiration of having produced that screen that became the facade of the U.S. Pavilion, because it was more than just a panorama of that very strange site where the border wall, after traveling miles in the Tijuana territory, finally sinks into the Pacific Ocean. But juxtaposed to that image, there is a horizon, which I ended up calling sort of a horizon of conflict, gathering a series of environments where ecologies collide. And somehow in those contexts of conflict, I was arguing, is where architectural practice should reposition itself and redefining our own procedures, you know, our own modes of operation of intervention, let's say, in the city, in the territory. So that implies, of course, very much the intention of this question in redefining the critical interfaces, not only with the territory, but of course with communities of practice that I began to discover somehow revealed in the back of these characters or these communities or these neighborhoods that have become the laboratory for my own work. So in a sense, I think that this issue of the return to the territory across fields to really investigate the very forces that are constructing these strange conditions is part of all of our own desire, I think. But in the context of that, I'm thinking that what has been inspiration to me has been to try to understand the certain intelligence embedded somehow in the socioeconomic and spatial logics, let's say, of the informal, primarily connected somehow to immigrants and in this very contested territory. The role that immigrants have begun to play in the transformation of the American neighborhood, physically and in many other ways, because these informal logics could possibly become the inspiration to transform almost in a kind of trickling up effect the very policies that have, and the economics, let's say, of development that have perpetuated the recipes that we understand now have defined the idea of city as we know it. So very quickly, I thought of just sharing a couple of stories in this context. And one issue for me has been to understand the kind of retrofit of Levittown that has occurred as many older neighborhoods in Southern California, primarily located in the first ring of suburbanization, have begun to be transformed. And so I began to construct very, I don't know if to call them naive, but very plain drawings or diagrams that would suggest and that become tools for me to engage conversation with neighborhoods, with community activists and politicians to really talk about the drama of these at times invisible dynamics that are really ignored by our institutions. And primarily at a time when we are trying to redefine institutions to understand a very different procedure and the meaning of infrastructure or density and so on, it's important to engage that debate. So one first image is this one, because imagine at the most trafficked border in the world, Tijuana, San Diego, not one single land use map exists between these two cities as a kind of coherent sort of relationship so that these two cities could begin to anticipate their futures and sharing infrastructure and so on. So I put together in a very plain way the two ideas of land use for these two cities. On one hand, on the top, of course, the large swatches of color of San Diego's land use as these very typical notions of dividing uses in very large sectors, let's say, construct that image. And on the south, the high pixelation, let's say, of Tijuana's land use, which is, of course, very three-dimensional and very intensive in the relationship of use and so on. And I began to understand that in the last 30 years, this high pixelation has begun to seep into and contaminate somehow these large swatches of land use and deposited itself in many of these older neighborhoods located particularly in the first ring of suburbanization, the old levy towns, let's say, of the post-war. I began to realize also that it is in fact the two main places of intervention in our imagination, let's say, whether through governance, academia, or development, have been located in the last years in downtowns across the United States and the world, where, of course, downtowns have become bubbles of wealth surrounded by neighborhoods of precariousness, and of course, producing this huge project of gentrification. And equally, on the other end, our interest in suburbia all of a sudden, without, of course, having the tools to enter into that environment. But nevertheless, suburbia used to be the alternative for affordability. Now it has become equally a very wealthy environment of high-priced infrastructure, master-planned communities, and so on. The place that we continue to ignore has been, in my argument in the last years, is in fact the very nature of these neighborhoods that could become the laboratory to redefine our idea, let's say, of infrastructure, mixed use, of density, and so on. These are the neighborhoods where many of these diasporas from Africa, Asia, and Latin America have been settling in the last 30, 40 years, unable, of course, now to afford the high rents of downtown and equally the very high price real estate of the periphery, but somehow conveniently becoming the service sector that feeds with cheap labor these two environments. So part of the suggestion, of course, is that the levy towns, this first ring of suburbanization that probably 30, 40 years ago looked like this, a typical idea, again, of this urbanism of sameness, have begun to be pixelated in the last 30, 40 years by these socio-economic, let's say, non-conforming patterns of growth, of density, and these temporal dynamics, let's say, in the shape of illegal uses, a small addition or two or three additions in the back of an official house, a small business that is plugged into a garage, and so on. So this pixelation or retrofit, let's say, of the levy towns with difference, with this alternative and invisible stealth type of land use, begins to probably be an inspiration to, particularly at our time, redefine our idea of land use and so on. And this takes us, of course, to the story that I've been trying to gather, which is the story of the non-conforming Buddha, which is, in fact, a post-war bungalow in one of these neighborhoods that has been transformed in the last 25 years into a Buddhist temple. And in so doing, it challenges our notion of the unit of housing as the measuring, as the abstract measuring of density, because this is not anymore a unit of housing and this generic parcel. It has become now an agency that negotiates and calibrates the transactions economically, socially, pedagogically with the neighborhood. So how to measure this, of course, dynamics is continues to be off the radar for our institutions. And so the speculation has been, of course, if the first ring of suburbanization has transformed so radically in the last 30, 40 years, what will happen to the second, third, fifth ring of suburbanization, as probably now the Mac Mansions being built in the periphery of San Diego would have to be retrofitted for difference to accommodate, of course, maybe three more units and a small economy. Now, this is the exercise that I gave myself in constructing this piece, where basically it was a Mac Mansion that I went to measure. It was the most generic I could find, a 9,000 square feet Mac Mansion in the periphery of San Diego. And there's a two-channel video where in one, in front of this real Mac Mansion, these four or five immigrants are telling the story. In other words, imagining how this Mac Mansion would transform if they could do it by bringing their extended families and so on. And on the left, the Mac Mansion begins to mutate. Of course, the image was borrowed or appropriated by ArchiZoom, the famous glass box that is called Nonstop City, because I believe that in some way what is at stake here, even at our moment of environmental crisis and an economic crisis, is in fact a non-stop sprawl. And so this idea that not only the alteration by immigrants, but this retrofit that has so much logic in terms of economic and social sustainability is important here in terms of a typological set of alterations. As an architect, I'm fascinated somehow by that. But primarily, I think recently I've been realizing that the main issue is the pixelation of ownership. That what the first thing that will occur, and I see is already happening, I've seen enough to read some articles in the New York Times as these McMansions are being now squatted, or maybe a property owner has been forced to rent it to two small families to support a mortgage. The idea that property needs to be redefined in this condition. What do we mean by private property in the context of this social crisis? Probably a notion of social property might come back, but nevertheless, it is important to begin there. The redefinition of property and of ownership in the context of this retrofit of suburbia. So that's one, let's say, I don't have to call it diagram, but one thought in this context. And the other one might really have to do with another sort of, if I can loosely call it, community of practice, as these teenagers in San Diego invaded a leftover space, which has been another case story for my practice a bit recently, a chronology of an invasion that has to do now with the other side of the coin. On one hand, the redefinition of ownership to understand clearly one particular question from this outset. Who owns the resources? On the other end, the issue of whose property is it, after all? Political jurisdiction and economic power, let's say, as it is imprinted in the territory. So one exercise, equally naive, hopefully, is the erasure of the city and leaving just the archipelago of emptiness in San Diego, all this leftover, this compendium of voices, leftover spaces, and to realize that behind that physicality of that network of leftover spaces, there is a network of backward urban planning policies that have, in fact, produced that fragmentation. And they have names: vacant lots, easements, watersheds, brownfields, and the most radical one for me is that one that is called Paper Street. And I don't know if you know what Paper Street is. Some of you planners might know it, but Paper Street is an actual terminology used by the planning code in Southern California, particularly because I don't think in New York you have leftover streets. But the point is that at some point in the pre-Levittown moment where the planners just graduated from Harvard were in downtown San Diego with green markers, you know, drawing the grid that would become the city, they just dumped it later in the topography. When the surveyors went out there to actually measure that and to build that street, they found that they couldn't because there was a topographic condition that would make it very expensive. So they just registered that street. They never built it. That's the reason it's called Paper Street. So that's a chunk of forgotten public possibility. And who is taking advantage of this? Well, developers, private developers who actually claim that because these streets are not being used, they can, in fact, claim them as their territory to amplify and increase their private property. And there is a process called street vacation. And if nobody complains in the neighborhood, these developers can increase their property. So this is the material. These are the sites where artists and architects could be locating themselves and reclaiming these chunks of forgotten legislature. So one aspect that has become important for me has been to see the leftover in very complex and equally simple ways. Instead of seeing it as an autonomous piece, always seeing these leftover vacant lots in the context of mini networks located at the scale of the neighborhood. So that diamond-shaped piece that is over there is a vacant lot that we were trying to activate in our office. And look at the little box next to it. It's a warehouse. And what we began to realize by just drawing very simply the alleys that are underutilized and some of the other sort of emptiness, let's say, that is around it, we realized that when we went to the places themselves, we knocked on the doors of the agencies that were surrounding these vacant sites. We realized that warehouse was, in fact, one of the most famous skateboard companies in the world, and yet its doors were close to the neighborhood. We realized that one block down, there was a Lady of Guadalupe church where a group of young artists would meet every week because they were trying to produce a project of photographing their neighborhood and constructing a memory archive for the neighborhood. That an alley connected one block later an elementary school. We realized that all these agencies, they did not recognize each other, and that, in fact, all of those agencies had budgets, programs that could be ultimately reconfigured to produce very interesting collaborations to then inject alternative programming in some of those vacant parcels. So in essence, what I'm trying to suggest simply, of course, is something very obvious, is that we as artists or architects, I think, could inject our own processes in constructing these alternative collaborations, in reconfiguring resources, in reconfiguring alliances to produce this possible alternative public realm. Look at this. This is a paper freeway. a freeway that was never built and produces huge leftover space with the trails, the informal trails that connect some of these environments. Of course, all of these environments are, if we knock on doors, they are all surrounded and framed by nonprofit organizations sometimes at the community level, elementary schools, recycling centers, all of them are ignoring each other somehow. So to finalize this quick moment is then the story of these teenagers, and I've been investigating this particular leftover space near my house, which is a typical gap that occurs between freeway and community. And I've been interviewing them in the last year because their story is compelling. They actually told me that at some point, this is 10 years ago when they did this, at one night they decided, tired of really looking for places to where to skate board, they decided to go to Home Depot, buy some shovels, and move to this empty space under the freeway and actually encroach into it and begin to dig to dig with the shovels to construct their own skateboard park. This is, in fact, the shape that the municipality gives to identify this leftover space. So after 2 weeks, they were barricaded. They were stopped by the police. And they told me, I've been trying to construct this story, to construct a series of narratives. They told me that the first thing that they had to do, these are teenagers, they had to actually recognize the political jurisdiction, the conditions of political power inscribed in that leftover space. They told me that they were lucky because they hadn't dug under Caltrans territory. Caltrans is the state agency that controls freeway. If they had done that, it would have been impossible to negotiate because this is a very fascist, institution, the freeway. They were lucky that they dug beneath an arm of the freeway that belonged to the city. They also were lucky, they told me, to have begun digging in a kind of Bermuda Triangle of jurisdiction, because it was in between Port Authority, Airport Authority, two city districts in the city or with two different council members. Nobody wanted to take responsibility for this. And further, a series of review boards. So the recognition first of those boundaries, those invisible political boundaries jurisdictionally, but also that behind each of those boundaries there were institutions, there were characters, political actors, budgets, and resources that they could manipulate. This is what the teenagers told me. The second condition was, of course, that now they were very pissed because they were stopped, right, the teenagers, and now they were ready to fight the city. In fact, they threatened to sue the city, but they had to really begin this process of negotiation. They had to talk to the city attorney, be aware of the laws embedded in the idea of public space and public institution, in this case, parks and recreation as an entity of the municipality. They were advised by the city and the city attorney that they had to become an NGO in order to operate. They had to really contact other skateboarders in Northern California who had gone through similar process because they had not only technical expertise, but they knew how to organize themselves. They had to get a lawyer, get insurance, and of course really create a network of fundraising and support to further understand their possibilities. So the economic conditions that really surrounded this political territory, that the city had budgets that were fragmented and that they were not being utilized, and so on. So the point is that at the end of the day, the recognition, this is primarily the message, that no intervention in the territory, public art in my mind, I've been very dissatisfied. It has become, just like architecture, a way of camouflaging the mistakes of bad planning. And in so on, a lot of our effort at this moment, I think, has to do with an idea of intervention that begins by recognizing political jurisdiction and economic power embedded in these environments. They were able, in fact, because of that process, to win the case, and because of a transfer of liability, the city gave them the space to construct the skateboard park. So this transference from the kind of informal dynamics, let's say, of of these moments of encroachment, okay, that are very fascinating, how there is a process of evolution that allows these actions to really trickle up in redefining particular aspects of policy, and of course of alternative economies, because I believe that in this moment of crisis, economically, we are finally going to realize that it's not the neoliberalist sort of recipes of privatization and development that will call the shots, but probably new economies or new ideas of the market could emerge from within communities. I don't know how I'm doing with time. Can I? So this notion of pixelating the large with the small is what has been an interest of mine in terms of challenging our very reductive ideas at this moment of sustainability and of density and of mixed use. I think that it's unavoidable. I come from the mother. This is California. It's the epicenter of oil-hungry urbanization, of selfish development, in a sense. But when we notice what are we doing as institutions, we are seemingly just camouflaging this faulty policy with technology or conditions that really take us away from the core of the problem. Unless we alter the nature of these politics and economics of development, you know, there was the very policies themselves that have supported this selfish urbanization, we are not going to really move one degree. I think that recently I heard a talk by Jim Consler, a writer, who said, you know, I've been traveling across the U.S., and it seems that everybody is clamoring for solutions, he said. But it seems to me that those solutions are just trying to maintain our lifestyle. Says we have to make different arrangements. And I think that for that really sent a strong message to me, because one particular aspect has to really, of course, having to do with understanding this critical interface with these environments, with these communities, where some of these very experimental, at times invisible dynamics are taking place, and how we as artists or architects could translate those dynamics into possible vehicles or instruments of operation. So one main issue, just to finalize, is this notion of density. How do we really calibrate or recalibrate our definition of density? I say this because I'm really, really worried that even the most progressive government, as we are lucky to have at this moment, is already sending very strange messages about how we need to generate jobs in order to buy cars, or how to really invest in infrastructure means to just fix roads or add two more lanes to the freeway, instead of actually understand the relationship of infrastructure to community, maybe. So it's essential that as we rethink the institutions at this very unprecedented juncture in our history, we also redefine the cliches that we have perpetuated both from the perspective of the architect and from the perspective, in fact, of the cliches of the community itself. So we've been exchanging or designing somehow workshops when we are working in our projects. Like this is a density a game that we produced in this neighborhood of San Isidro. How much did I go over?
Five minutes.
Perfect. In this neighborhood of San Isidro where we've been working, so part of the idea was we need to redefine the exchange or the communication or the language somehow with this neighborhood, with the people in this neighborhood, to understand what really we mean by density. And so we produced this game very quickly. The idea was to go back, the right click, Aaron? No. Oh, yeah. Okay. And we brought wood blocks representing units, trees, cars. And this is my table. We were, all over this gymnasium in this neighborhood, and I asked my table to produce 14 units of housing with so many cars. This is what the city would ask an architect, and everybody froze. At some point, this lady from Guadalajara was the first one to move, and she put one wood block in one parcel, another wood block on another parcel, and very soon she constructed or reconstructed the reality of her own block, individual houses on individual lots. So at some point, somebody said, well, what would happen if we put the two houses together and there is going to be a garden that is shared in the middle? Or maybe there is a passage between the alley and the street. And all of a sudden, the lady went crazy and started to put wood everywhere on the block. And so she, in Spanish, told me at some point, she said, I cannot believe it. These houses are selfish. This is where I borrow the term. It says selfish urbanism, right? And so she said, an idea of, she said, I remember when I was a young girl, she said, in Guadalajara, Mexico, now that I think of it, the block where I used to live was not one, like little buildings, but it was a whole block, she said. And actually there were spaces. She began to imagine that density was not made of objects, but of spaces that were interrelated somehow. That opened up a space of conversation. But then later it was clear to her, and she came up with this in Spanish, that density was some level of complexity, as I translated it, of course, but that it could be based on the collaboration across the property owners of that block, because she knew them all, and that they could eliminate their property lines by sharing some of these spaces. So neighborhood density at the scale of the neighborhood implies collaboration and redefines the meaning of housing. So this is particularly the issue for me is, very quickly, because I know that it had to do with this question, how do we demolish our clichés about density? It's amazing that we continue to measure density as an abstract equation, an amount of units per acre, and an amount of people per acre. We should begin by really reconsidering the ways of modes of representation that can translate, hopefully, more in a more inclusive way, some of these informal dynamics. Because if we really think of density at the scale of the neighborhood, density could, in fact, be translated as the amount of socioeconomic exchanges per acre, maybe. And that has really opened up a very different image, not only in terms of representation, but of operation. So for me, it has been important in these neighborhoods to begin working with not the design of buildings, but with the design probably of political process and, of course, of economic pro forma, alternative economic frameworks that can produce very different idea of affordability. I don't have time to show the very essence of this in the context of a micro policy that we designed with the nonprofit in this neighborhood, where we began to negotiate across institutions to allow these nonprofits to become developers of their own housing stock within these neighborhoods by translating the logics of the informal, in fact, in suggesting ideas of volunteerism, of course, sweat equity in exchange for rent, the variety of dynamics that the teenagers ultimately engaged in their own project. And, of course, many of these efforts translate into actual spatial tactics as some of these projects in these neighborhoods all really send a very very clear message, in a sense, simple. Housing cannot be looked at, cannot be understood on its own terms. Housing cannot just be units, even if they're cheap. They're not cheap house. There's no cheap housing nevertheless, right? But actually, as we have noticed, that the economic crisis began with a simple, somehow, but also complex condition that people could not pay loans, that in conditions of poverty and marginality, this American dream to own a unit cannot be sustained. So they need to rethink property and of economic models, let's say, is fundamental. So housing needs to be plugged with support systems, economic, social, pedagogical support systems. And in these very small parcels where we have been operating, this is the idea that this project has a garden, the remodeling of a church, a frame with electricity, and the housing is inserted into this mini system of economic, social, pedagogical, and cultural support systems facilitated and choreographed by the nonprofits located in those environments. So that's probably what, in essence, in the conclusion, in terms of the question, is not, well, should the architect define the program or should be the community's responsibility? Of course, clearly, hopefully, in exposing these moments, is neither or. It's, I think, primarily the need to problematize the debate, to demystify, in fact, the clichés that come from either side and engage in a more interesting and experimental process of communication. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So for this second question, we have another stellar list of agents provocateurs, among which Jean Gartner, who are here, who teaches at Parsons also and has worked on similar issues for a long time. Graham Shane from Colombia, thank you for joining us. I saw you wrote a lot of notes. Miodrag Mitrazinovic, who's hiding in the back, from Design Strategies, trained himself as an architect, and our special guest, John Thakra, who kindly stayed for the rest of the week to be part of this conversation. So again, I'm going to start passing the mic around to these agents, and who wants to be first?
Thank you so much for bringing us a new way of thinking about what an architect is. And I couldn't help but be drawn to the very first thing you said, where I live. And then you started talking about the special intelligence of the people where you live and how much you have positioned yourself as the person who can hear them and has skills like the pixelization of San Diego by the immigrant population to show the policymakers and the property owners. So it seems to me you're redefining architecture at the same time you're redefining these cracks, these cliches, these places that are open for the future, that the whole profession, teaching architects, as you've lived it, is something I feel is absolutely where the profession should be going. And I'm interested in how, if you took this conversation to the profession, what you would say about education. In other words, should only someone who's lived in San Diego, be talking to the neighborhood? And what is the difference when professionals come in from outside and follow the procedure you did? It seems to me that it's very important, that first sentence, where I live.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that, again, this is a sampling of a couple of conditions that have been important to me, but in the context of the larger story that I always tell about our small practice, it really begins with this notion that somehow that the need to radicalize the local, that recognition of the, again, of those very conditions of jurisdictional and economic power that define the territory, the environments as the ones that I showed, I mean, to really enter into the space of the local with different eyes. Because, of course, part of the problem is that all of our institutions have denigrated the local as provincial and as not that experimental, but we are always trying to really deal with this global top-down sort of dynamics. And part of the issue here is not only the negotiation between the formal and the informal, but ultimately between the top-down and the bottom-up. And a lot needs to be said. And it's great that now, you know, this political process has yielded the potential of social networks and grassroots efforts to really suggest that there is a voice out there that is equally as powerful. Because after all, if you really think about the economic recipes that seemingly were officially determining the city, were embedded or in illegality themselves, right? So this is, everything is up for grabs. But nevertheless, first is that I really truly believe that what has helped me a lot in understanding this, even though I've always dreamt to live in New York, you know, and it was really to understand that the work really was there, in seemingly in the kind of behind the generic pastoral harmonious facades of the suburbia, there was an animal emerging of complexity, of conflict in many ways. So yes, grounding the work in a very small scale. And then further to really select a neighborhood. For the last 6-7 years, I've been trying to understand via these characters that have become these very incredible political actors and so on. And I say this because also in the context of academia, everything that has to do with community design is always seen as, you know, not that necessarily artistic or experimental. And I truly believe that behind the economic, social, and political policies in these non-profit organizations, there is an amazing experimental work really occurring. And architects, of course, have been absent from understanding that that could inspire particular spatial practices. And maybe the other scale that I would like to mention in the context of your question is, of course, that that's where our gaze was so anchored in the Dubais of the world, in China, the single-handedly the place that was reconfiguring itself in very interesting ways politically and economically is Latin America, where in fact top-down governments are beginning to look at the power of social networks and informal economics as a way of redefining notions of urbanization. And so I think that all of those projects in Latin America, whether it's Curitiba or Bogota or Medellin, in the hands of very, in fact, mayors who came from academia, philosophers, mathematicians who needed to enter into the realm of politics, they began all those projects with an urban pedagogy. All of them, if you really measure them, all of them really produced a very intelligent project of civic awareness, of eco-literacy, to really demystify the meaning of some of these chunks of, they say, what public space, what is that? In Medellin, they decided no public space in Medellin will be now produced without plugging it with knowledge. So they began to create these hybrids of library parks, or, again, beautiful stories. I say this because I always dreamt to that the message would be projected that the third world will teach the first when it comes in terms of social sustainability. So, yes, the pedagogical dimension is the most fundamental at this moment. And I say this in the kind of resonance or in terms of our profession and our education as architects, that our institutions continue to be absent from those dynamics. I think it's important to relocate, you know, where the site of true experimentation is. So more or less that, I hope I addressed the question, yeah.
John?
Yes.
It's embarrassing. I couldn't see behind. I was wondering, out of the education thing that you were saying, if you imagine when it scales up, does it become like the drawing that you have here? And so then all the micro organisms start working in each patch, and so the city starts transforming from below. And then how do you manage, I mean, this is things I think about too.
Yes.
How do you manage the complexity of the city? When you went into the skateboard park, you hit, you know, all the realities. How do you manage these big institutions that run the city, infrastructure that, of course, may decay and disappear? And how, you know, how does the hybridity come through? I mean, in theory and in education, we can think of the bottom-up taking over, but in reality, we know that this could be a war zone, that there's each one could be against each other, the thing could collapse into a sort of chaotic microsystem against microsystem. And so how would you rebalance it? You know, my answer is through informational systems and community links and all sorts of things, but how would you do that? You're coming from the bottom up. How do you do? What do you do with the top-down infrastructures?
Mm-hmm.
And then I have this other thing, which is like it's a trick. How do you scale up if when you want, you know, when you have a problem scaling down? So that's my question. Sorry.
Yes. No. It's great. first of all, at times I feel compelled to clarify, and it's obvious that I'm fascinated by the bottom up and the informal. At the same time, I don't want to perpetuate this cliche, and some of my friends say, "Oh, you are the shanty guy, or the, you know, or the bottom up." You know, and that has polarized the academia as well. To tell you the truth, the formalists and their obsession with hyper aesthetics, camouflaging this faulty policy and these huge economic recipes, not participating at all on the political debate, and on the other, informalists, trivializing the kind of struggles and the economic, socio-economic processes. I'm interested in understanding the informal, not because of its image, but really what is behind it. I think there are very sophisticated, again, procedures that can be abstracted, translated, and reconfigured and dumped back into the official city. Sometimes that act of translation, which is important for my practice, not only implies a very different idea of research and practice, but it can be located in a very small project, without the pretension that that project will really do this large thing. And this is what I have been able to kind of stop myself from doing. I said, let's just begin small. Let's produce and hopefully build this project. It has been so difficult to get off the ground. And hopefully that begin to produce an example that can then trickle up in other ways. Of course, that has implied a conversation with politicians in San Diego, with the planning department, in constructing interesting alliances. So I'm saying this in terms of the informal, because that also has been in the formal, a debate, you know, but not to occupy so in a deterministic way either side, but to problematize this relationship between the top-down and the bottom-up. I think that in the way the image is, is logic, you know, logical. Somehow this could begin to tie into a larger system. But I think that we would have to suspend this belief in a moment, and probably, Rick was saying, you know, you have to stop being an artist. Sometimes you have to stop being the architect in terms of obsessing with the kind of controlling of that destiny of the city, in allowing a gesture to really be catalytic, but with implications that we are risking something, of course, right? That this, and allow that to occur and unfold. I think that that's probably what has been in the back of my mind, is that this project might be anticipatory of patterns of relationship in this neighborhood, and hopefully, as you had already suggested, and politicians are listening in San Diego, probably it might begin to encroach into the rigidity of the categories of zoning. And that's already enough as a first gesture. What happens later is I cannot control.
I love the picture of the circle, I mean, about a third of the way in, where you had the kind of service sector in the kind of peri-urban bit and the kind of rich white downtown and the rich white outer suburbs. It reminds me of my basic proposition about gated communities, is their main function is to keep rich white people locked up so they can't do any more damage. And I love this image because, I mean, over the last right at the beginning you talked about the moment of crisis.
Yeah.
This is a kind of rhetorical thing. I don't think we're in a moment of crisis. I think we're in a new reality which will persist for the rest of our lives. So what you're describing is how do people survive in different situations? And when you see complex, what you describe, well, volumes of complex economic exchange in a local area, that's where it will be easiest to survive in the future. So in a curious way, I'm not sure whether I understand why one would want to measure it unless one wanted to control it. So why do you want to measure this kind of complexity unless you think, well, we should have it all put in a nice box somewhere? But it kind of goes back to what the previous presentation, Rick. I think that it ends up being about identifying people in situations who have energy, positive energy, have creative solutions to very practical problems, and asking them, either as individuals or as groups, what practical obstacles do you face at a kind of in terms of space or equipment or communications? And by the way, how can we help you deal with those practical obstacles rather than arrive looking for the possibility to make a plan?
Great. Wow, so you really hire some agent provocateurs. So first of all, I think that there is a contradiction, of course, which is another moment of risk. In terms of mapping the illegal or the cartography of non-conformity, because, of course, the argument from many artists would say, so why are you eradicating the magic of the informal? Because, after all, it depends on levels of insurgency. Okay, fine, let's for a moment leave those communities, you know, rot in their poverty or in their economic depression. I think that at times I think it's important to suggest that these dynamics, again, could translate into procedures that can alter, of course, these situations of regulation, but of course of economic pro forma. And I've always say that in the context of the kind of formalization of the informal, just a bit, okay, with that, because in a sense it's not about commodifying the informal in this case. It's a very difficult topic and it's fundamental for me. But to what degree you allow this relational kind of urbanism at the scale of this neighborhood to produce a very different idea of economy? Already part of our projects really suggests that these nonprofit organizations could, by transfer of liability, could become the translators of social service, let's say, volunteerism. This is where the service sector lives in those neighborhoods. So time banking, all of these notions that are coming back to us, that these nonprofits could translate all that volunteerism, that willingness, that levels of coexistence into economic models. These acts of translations suggest a very different reconfigurations, again, of not only the transference of modes of production. I believe that neighborhoods are environments of production. They are not just, as architects, they just want to give shelter to people. I've been thinking that it is about the idea that a unit of dwelling could become an economic model, an economic engine, and so on. So it is about the economy, and it is about the kind of, again, political rearrangement of land use. So in a sense, it has to begin by mapping those relations in some way. In fact, our project depended on mapping all the illegal additions in these neighborhoods and coming to the city and say, look, this is already there, and it makes sense. And the city is now, you know, asked to really legitimize a very different, because of the existence of those models of sustainability, a very different idea of land use. On the other hand, of course, for me, it has been an issue because architects are so far from understanding the economic logics of development, is to realize that the most beautiful parts of Los Angeles that I have been noticing, next to Wilshire Boulevard, all that fabric of duplexes and fourplexes responding to an economic model of sustainability. This is duplexes where a property owner could live in the premise while having an extra unit to rent, or fourplexes. So the economic models, the performance, and the lending models were supporting a very different idea, let's say, of ownership, right? So it's What is the name of that? The lending, the loan that is particular to that is living or the owner lives in the premises and so on. So this relationship between, again, the formal and the economic, I think, is a very essential one. And I think that to map, the idea of mapping in this case takes a very different scale because, and go back to the notion of crisis. I feel for me it's essential that we really, primarily in this country where we always try to hide everything under the rug, the idea is that we need to understand what is behind that crisis, what really are the conditions that produce that conflict, because those elements become material for design in my mind. And that implies, of course, all of these elements, and particularly embedded in these neighborhoods, the potential that, again, sweat equity, participation, can be translated into an economy. So I think it's an important aspect to be amplified. But, of course, at the end of the day, one risks, and let's go back to the contradiction, the kind of commodification in certain ways of these dynamics, and that's where social and economic contracts need to be defined further. I could go on this point because Hernando de Soto in Latin America has been criticized, in fact, the economist who said, let's give property titles to slum dwellers. But that's not just a solution, somebody else said, because what prevents this slum dweller from just investing now in his property or her property and then selling it to somebody else and move to the next slum? These processes need to be supported by mediating agencies that can monitor socioeconomic injustices. So part of this idea of translation of these logics need those interpreters, in a sense. And that implies, of course, an act of recognizing the potential that has become invisible to our modes of representation of the city.
We're going to leave the agent in the dark here. Just ask the last question, and then I'll pass the mic around.
Hi. Since I'm supposed to provoke, I will try to provoke. But let me first say there was a very beautiful, very indicative coincidence at the show itself, where your panorama forms a horizon line, and then within on the screen there is a projection of Kyung Park's project, the International Center for Urban Ecology, who talks about again the horizon line beyond picturesque, beyond panoramic. And towards an attempt to understand how the horizon line has been used as a vehicle of enabling people to understand their position in the world, to acquire a position of stability in relation to the world they inhabit. And what is really interesting to me that you are positioning, even in the talk today, you're positioning your idea of the horizon here as a horizon of conflict, where one can potentially read the urbanism or juxtaposition that you talked about frequently in other occasions also. And the work, as I see it, is very powerful in a sense in which it enables the people you work with, the communities you work with, to understand where the horizon line is. In fact, it does exactly what you are trying to do, which is to say it radicalizes the local and it problematizes the debate. In fact, it makes people aware that they are in a conflict situation. Therefore, everything else they hear about, you know, the American dream, the images of, you know, becoming wealthy and prosperous and so on and so forth, in fact, is just an attempt to impose an ideology upon them that you are trying to discredit. So if I were to search for a theoretical framework and for an ideological framework that you actually never explicitly address in your work and in your presentations, the thing I would, you may agree or disagree, and that may be the one of the lines of provocation, is this would be the pedagogy of the oppressed. In other words, what you are really trying to do is to enable people to engage in a conflict and provide the tools for them to not only understand their position within it, but also to enable them to achieve something through the conflict, to realize themselves through this particular idea of conflict. All right. Where that leads me, it's two lines of provocation. First, because it's the stability is the key. To my mind, the stability of the people you are working with is the key. But to what end is the question? And that's why I said there are two lines of provocation. One line of provocation is, what are they going to be able to do once they're enabled, right? And goes back to some previous questions. And potentially, this risk, being naive in face of economic, political power, and so on and so forth. The second question is, the work is also extremely powerful in a way in which you in such a sophisticated way make references to Archizum and the Situationist and all of those art and design and architecture movements in the 20th century that really employed critique in order to launch their own position, their own kind of ideological position in relation to socioeconomic and political forces. So the critique is definitely a mode of production of the knowledge, of a particular type of knowledge. Now, can that knowledge be formalized? And therefore, since you're also a professor at the university, can that knowledge be formalized? And what kind of profession are you talking about? Who are you going to teach, and what are these people going to do? Not the community members. The community members have the stability, they know what to do, and they potentially will win whatever they're going to win about. But what about the students? How do you then bring that knowledge into the university? And what would that knowledge enable your students to do? I would provoke you by saying that I don't see this as a model of professional or architectural practice.
Okay.
I won't recap. I hope you got it.
Yeah. My message is a lot simpler than yours. And it has to do with the fact that no advances in housing design can be made without advances in housing policy, without advances in economic models. This is what my client, the nonprofit community activist, told me. I've been repeating it to myself all the time. As an architect, I could choose very well to be in an office constructing beautiful models, responding to a developer's proforma, subordinating my own creative mind, seemingly, to camouflage these, hyper private models of privatization, with the latest skin in the technology. The technology is made available. I can very well choose to do that, but at some point, it really bore me to suggest that that's what I wanted to do. I think, in essence, to enter into the political debate of constructing city, to really enter into the politics and economics that have been constructing our model of city is fundamental for our profession. That's the reason, because of what you're saying, is the reason the humanities, the arts, have been so relegated to a superfluous sphere. I see it all the time in the institution where I teach. It is a big departments of science and technology who get all the funding because seemingly they are doing the rigorous work. Humanities and the arts, which of course involve architecture, could also enter into that debate critically by translating some of these dynamics. So there is a space of operation for the architect within that. The expanded models of practice that are needed. Not all of us want to design buildings or protagonist structures. Some of us want to also design political models and economic, as I said, processes. So I disagree with you in that, and you can see that I get emotional, but thanks for provoking me. But I think that that's particularly the apathy that has been produced in terms of not participating, because we have been all enjoying the kind of fruits of an economic models that ended up being incredibly faulty. So, and also in the context of institutions, similarly, studios of design in our schools of architecture, or for that matter anywhere, could be looking at the best practices that have been emerging from the global south, could be translating some of those dynamics, because what Jamie Lerner did in Curitiba continues to be published just as a result, as a product, not as a process that was incredibly smart, or what Enrique Peñalosa and Mocus did in Bogota, or what Sergio Fajardo did in Medellin. They engaged a very creative process of triangulation across industries, across social networks, bottom-up practices to produce very intelligent projects of infrastructure. Now when we are rethinking finally ourselves here to produce a very different idea of public institution, those are the models that we need to be investigating. And I think that schools need fundamentally to take the role of translators of those dynamics. And so, and I forget another question that you had in that context, but probably that's this idea of, again, knowledge, right? Can you remind me, there was another piece in your question? Yes, I ended up, the simple message that I got, began, because of course I am enamored with theory. I mean, theory is an instrumental procedure of critical, again, action. It's not packaged. It's not canonized. There's a reason theory and practice have been so polarized and continue, in a sense. But also our infatuation with theory right now, the question or the death of theory, as some people have called it, is because our need to enter practice. But of course, without theory, it doesn't. It's a process that we need to reconstruct. And so I think that ultimately the message for me continues to be simple in this case, even though, of course, I borrow from situationism because I'm infatuated by those moments. It's not important as a personal, at times, device. The point is that in understanding the intelligence of these social networks or these dynamics, at the end, as an architect, I want to translate that into very particular formal procedures. So in my case, I've been interested in the pixelation of the size of parcels in San Diego, challenging the minimum parcel size. When I talked about Los Angeles, it was exactly that. Duplexes and fourplexes, it was owner-occupied. There is a bracket in the lending structure that is owner-occupied. A fourplex, you can get a very different model or loan that is more beneficial, let's say. So to understand that lending and land use are imprinted on the size of the city, and to think that that project is incredibly experimental, that by pixelating that parcel with a very different size of a project, I need to do that with my projects. I need to pull them apart in terms of formal strategies, because architects' friends always give me a hard time. You know, there is also a formalist attitude in your project, in aesthetics, that is important to talk about, and that's an important issue. But again, at the end, is really having to do with these dynamics can be translated into actual spatial practice. And that's the beauty of it. I think that the gap between social responsibility and artistic experimentation need to be reduced. And embedded in these neighborhoods is a huge, huge project of experimentation going on that we have been ignoring.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There was one question here, so.
The answer is
I won't go on at a long distance, but I would love to. But all I just want to say is the model that you're presenting in a way has been practiced for at least 20 years in Seattle and Portland, and probably in Minneapolis also. And I just wonder what your critique is of that educated, middle-class version of the same kind of community organizing, coming together, building communal spaces, recreating ravines into public spaces, developing co-housing strategies, lobbying for higher density within various neighborhoods in order to make things happen, and acceptability and acknowledgement of halfway houses within their neighborhoods and accommodating them, but also from this kind of grassroots level in which politicians said, eventually, I'm going to listen to you as a neighborhood and we're going to do what you want to do. And that's basically the Seattle-Portland ethic. And so I just wondered how you feel about that model as opposed to what you're doing here.
Yeah, that's a good question. And of course, not only the last 20 years, it's been here on the map for a long, long time. So part of the issue, again, of the responsibility of our institutions is to recuperate those models. Very radical moments in the history of the U.S., in particular New York, in terms of these issues of property, cohabitation and so on. But I think that at the end of the day, I think part of the issue that has been, and this is very difficult, it's a good question, it has been perpetuated in this distance from, let's say, academic models or experimental kind of processes of design that might resonate with these dynamics, is that there has been a polarity that a lot of those projects embedded in those neighborhoods with those grassroots efforts do not somehow translate into interesting, you know, aesthetic projects in a sense. I'm interested in that relationship of the formal and the socioeconomic in the sense. I feel that many times this antagonism is polarized, that good design is irresponsible in the context of social responsibility. I also realize that many of those projects remain very grassroots in the sense that they become bubbles in themselves. I have students who tell me, well, why do you want to deal with developers? So let's just create our own Christiana, you know, that neighborhood in Denmark. And in the sense for me, it's a difficult thing because a lot of these projects remain kind of bubbles and self-contained in their own and have not been able to really catapult themselves as devices to redefine the debate across their own boundaries, in a sense. And for me, probably in that sense, the idea that even theoretical ruminations or academic models of pedagogy or exchanging with these communities to really construct a very different, what I would hopefully call experimental architecture in a sense, could send a different message. I think at the end of the day, the efforts are really pretty much the same. They begin with understanding those relations, social and economic, as the basis for producing the different idea of sustainability. But very seldom they translate themselves into models that can trickle up to really have an effect in the larger politics of a particular environment. And this is the effort, which is a struggle, but the effort that really interests me in San Diego, that it could really trickle up to generate a very different idea of land use. Of course, being next to Tijuana makes it easy, or not easy, but more difficult, but when you have those conditions pressing against each other, the process can be amplified. These issues can be amplified even more in a very dramatic way. Thank you.